from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of this year's Indie Film Fest.
I'll talk with Allison Lynn about her new novel, The Exiles.
And I'll chat with Dance Kaleidoscope's David Hochoy about their upcoming concert, and there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Since 2004, the Indie Film Fest, also known as the Indianapolis International Film Fest, has been showing great independent movies from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. This year, the Indie Film Fest runs from July 18th through the 28th. Travis DiNicola spoke with board members Craig Mintz and Luke Sanders about this year's program.
Luke, Craig, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always good to see you guys, and congratulations on... Wait, is this the 11th year or 10th year?
10th.
Okay. 10th year of Indie Film Fest. Awesome.
Yeah.
You've both been involved, what, about 4 or 5 years yourself or so?
I've been involved for 5.
This will be my 4th.
Your 4th? Cool. And this is the best one yet, right?
Of course.
So the Indie Film Fest, which formerly is known, right, as Indianapolis International Film Fest?
Still is. That's the official title, you know, kind of we like to call ourselves the Indie Film Fest. It rolls off the tongue a little bit easier.
It does.
Yeah, we are the Indianapolis International Film Festival.
But films from all over the world, all over the country, independent films.
Studio releases. Mm-hmm. We run the gambit.
The whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, tell me about it. What's going on this year for the big 10th one? Luke, you're real involved, right, in operations and choosing films and this whole thing. So
yeah,
I mean, what a cool thing to be a part of, right?
That's right. Thank you. It really is. It's cool, but it's difficult. We get 650, 700 films, and we have to whittle down a cohesive, coherent festival down to 98 films, I believe, maybe 97 this year.
That's still a lot.
Few.
Yeah.
That's still a lot. Now, our screeners are the brave ones who kind of wait in the first lines, if you will, and watch all of these. But what we end up with is something invariably that goes across from films from a couple of minutes to a couple hours, from right here in Indianapolis to mm-hmm. the farthest corners of the globe. It's always exciting to see what all is coming in and call that into a great festival.
You know, there is something similar I've noticed about other members of the board of the film festival. You guys all kind of have that, like, you know, 100-yard stare of, like, you know, a little bit glazed over of looking at movies for too many hours on end and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
That is hard work to do.
You know, you think it's a cakewalk, and then a lot of people from the outside looking in, and you're like, oh, you got to watch movies, and you're like, yeah, I got to watch movies, lots and lots of movies. But, I mean, to a point, like, the screening committee, they are the, like Luke says, they're the front line. They get to watch them all, and kind of as it bubbles its way up is when we start to put eyes on things. But, it's a job in and of itself to watch movies.
So what's some of the criteria that you use, I mean, to pick this out? I mean, there isn't necessarily one dominant theme across the festival. I mean, I know certain, you know, evenings may have a theme or what have you, but there really isn't one specific theme. So how do you choose?
That's the beauty of it, that we don't have a specific theme, so anything really is fair game. I remember a couple of films in the past that were about a minute and a half, but they made such a great point or they had such a great joke that was the center of it. I think one area actually where the theme comes out really strongly is in the shorts programs, given that those are organized around a theme. And it is a challenge to put together a group of unrelated films into something that, again, tells a little bit of a story, centers around a theme. But as we watch them, there's always particular themes that come out. There's always a comedy series, and there's always a dramatic series. But this year we have one called The Hobbyist that's about individuals just dedicated to their craft. So we watched a number of those films. It became apparent that those films fit well together, and we made a shorts program out of it.
And the theme emerged.
Exactly. And, you know, honestly, great storytelling, I think, is the overarching theme. I mean, any film, you know, we don't kind of have any specifics, but we look for those films that speak to the heart, you know, things, those films that kind of just make you glad you're watching, you know, that film.
So what is it also that you think the film festival brings? I mean, you're not just showing films that people maybe can't see anywhere else, but you're also brings sort of that communal experience,
exactly.
A pretty intense 10 days.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we like to do is we want to, you know, everybody can watch movies at home anymore. You can watch movies that are even in the theater in some instances. You know, our big mission is to get people centered around film and get them talking about film and mm-hmm. being very social and interactive about it. So, you know, we want, you know, hundreds upon hundreds of people to come see, you know, a film about a high school basketball team and then have a serious conversation about it afterwards. So we really want to champion that experience that is kind of watching a movie as a group or watching a movie in a social setting.
So you mentioned the high school basketball team.
Yeah.
This is kind of interesting because the film itself, not only does it deal with an Indiana subject, but you're going to be showing it in the old gymnasium at the Harrison Center, right?
Yes, correct.
So, I mean, really sort of trying to pair. I mean, I know a lot of the movies take place at the IMA, but mm-hmm. In this case, you're really pairing the venue with the theme itself. Tell me more about that.
We've been doing a year-round program that we call Roving Cinema, where we pair the film with the venue. And, you know, they're mainly cult classics, movies that are very approachable, again, to get people out of the house. Even if you saw it, you know, yesterday on television, you'd want to go see it in that special setting. So we said, it's our 10th year. Let's do something fun. Let's go into the community. Let's paint Indianapolis as the backdrop, as the theater, if you will. And let's highlight some of our partners, some of the very unique venues. And it was tough, but we were able to come up with six different programs, the first of which is the screening of Medora, which is the documentary about Medora, Indiana, and the high school basketball team. We're going to screen that at the old gym at the Harrison Center for the Arts on Friday. The 19th. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're going to the Libertine one night. We're going to go to Tibbs Drive-In one night, kind of to hit up the Americana that is the drive-in. We're going to go to the Historical Society, the Idle Jorg, and then to Big Car Service Center, again, with movies that are themed to those venues.
Because what are you doing at Tibbs?
Tibbs, we're showing a movie called Lost for Words. Mm-hmm. It's out of Hong Kong, and it's kind of I don't know, Luke, how would you describe it? I like to describe it kind of a Romeo-Juliet set in another country. It's probably about 25% subtitled, quite a bit of English in it, but it's a very good dramatic love story.
Yeah, that was a good catch, Travis. I think you heard the excitement in Craig's voice when he mentioned the drive-in, so he just instinctively honed right in onto that.
So why did you guys choose that one for the drive-in? That's what I'm trying
It's kind of one of those romantic, films. Yeah, you know, we don't see a lot of kind of the classic horror movies come through the festival, although we would love if anybody's listening. Mm-hmm. So it was a matter of, okay, it's a good date night movie.
Yeah, okay.
And kind of for that, you know, the classic drive-in mentality, it was always kind of a date night thing, or it still is, actually. I mean, it's a very vibrant industry anymore. So we thought it would be a fun kind of film to program. Plus, in all honesty, it's very hard to find 35mm prints anymore, and that's all they can show at the drive-in.
Sure.
So so
that one worked well for them?
Exactly. It worked perfectly.
Cool. So look, what are you really looking forward to yourself here?
That's a really tough question.
One film.
So I think, just to kind of wrap up the discussion of the different venues around town, frankly, you know, movie theaters are great. Everyone loves going to a movie theater and sitting in the nice plush seats with the gum under the seat and enjoying an experience there. But by only having movies in movie theaters, I think you miss out on an opportunity to make the venue part of the experience. And that is really what I'm looking forward to. I've seen over my 3 festivals so far, I've seen a lot of movies in the IMA, a lot of great movies. I look forward to seeing more of them in the movie theater setting this year as well, and I'll certainly be present for many, if not all of them. But you never know what the screening in these venues is going to be like. Each one is different, the crowd, the noise, the aspects of the venue itself. So I'm looking forward not only to the films there, but to the experience of what being in each one of those places is going to be like.
Very cool. And of course, the whole schedule is available on the website at indiefilmfest.org, both for the movies at the IMA as well as these ones at the special venues stuff. Now, tickets ahead of time, how's that all work?
We're strongly suggesting, especially for some of the bigger stuff like the evening, you know, venturing out in the community, we're strongly suggesting people buy their tickets in advance. They, again, can go to the website. It will walk you through it. It's a very simple process. But yeah, it's some of these venues like the Harrison Center Gym or, you know, the Libertine are very small capacity crowds, so we can only get so many folks in. So we're asking people not to wait. And obviously, even some of the kind of bookend, like the opening and closing night, we're telling people to get tickets in advance.
So what are you guys showing at the Libertine?
It's a documentary.
I'm trying to picture where in the Libertine the movie is going to be.
They actually have an upstairs that they use for a lot of private rentals, but it's still connected, and we thought it was fitting. We have a documentary called Hey Bartender, and it's about the craft bartending movement. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, as we were sitting there watching this film, or at least I watched this movie, and I'm like, I could really use a drink. And it's like, what a better scenario. What a better setting. So we reached out to those guys. They were very excited. It's on the Monday night, and they're not normally open on Mondays, but after the screening, they're going to open up so everybody that's in the screening can go down and enjoy a drink.
Excellent.
Yeah.
It is impossible to not at least, you know, feel a little bit of the flavor. Each bartender, you know, some of the premier bartenders in the world in the film are introduced by a slow motion making of their favorite cocktail. So you have a close up of them muddling the mint leaves and crushing the ice.
You get really thirsty.
You get a little thirsty.
I'm getting thirsty just thinking about it. So what are some other collections of shorts or evenings of features that you guys both want to highlight? Not just the ones at the special venues, but throughout the whole festival.
Definitely. I think our opening and closing night, kind of our big evenings. Opening night this year is a film called Drinking Buddies that stars Olivia Wilde, Ron Livingston, Anna Kendrick, and Jack Johnson. And it's at the IMA. It's a kind of a story about relationships. It takes place in a brewery. So after the film, we're having a reception at Sun King Brewery.
Perfect.
So that's opening night. Closing night is it's the premiere of written and directed by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, a film called Don John.
Is this one with Scarlett Johansson?
It is. Yeah. He stars in this opposite Scarlett Johansson, and it's it's a fascinating film. It's really good, and it'll be interesting to see what the Indianapolis market has to say about it. It'll be a fun watch. It'll be a fun discussion afterwards as well.
So anyone from the movie is going to be here?
The director for Drinking Buddies is going to be in. Joe Swanberg will be here. Obviously, we've reached out to Mr. Gordon-Levitt many a times. He's very busy man, very busy man. So I don't think we'll have anybody here for closing night, but a lot of directors are coming in town. A few of the cast I know from some of the films will be in town throughout the festival. And again, visit the website. We try to list all that information, whether it's through our blogs. You can also follow us on social media like Tweet and Facebook.
Excellent. Any other highlights you guys want to point out before we wrap this up?
Luke, I know you got a couple
and get
more
to the movies? Yeah.
Yeah. I think one that I would bring up Saturday evening screening of Blood Brother, which played at Sundance to rave reviews, is Craig talked about, I forget the word he used, something about just movies that you want to watch, movies that make you happy that you're living life. And this is one of them. Even if you shed a tear or two, it's in a very life-affirming way. So absolutely fantastic documentary, one that is not to be missed. I think just if I had to recommend one.
Yeah. And we're only screening it once that Saturday night.
Yeah,
because
I know some of the movies get multiple screens.
Yeah.
But okay.
Correct.
Okay, very good. Blood Brothers on Saturday night.
Blood Brother on Saturday night.
Excellent. Gentlemen, I hope you have some big tubs of popcorn, and
that'll be our dinner for the next few evenings every night.
Imagine so. Well, congratulations on the work you've done to make this happen, and I know it's going to be a great Indie Film Fest. Looking forward to it very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Indie Film Fest board members Craig Mintz and Luke Sanders. This year, the Indie Film Fest runs from July 18th through the 28th. The complete schedule of films is available at indiefilmfest.org. Again, indiefilmfest.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
With dark humor, Allison Lynn's new novel, The Exiles, explores what we do when the path of our lives change on both a personal and national level. The Butler University professor began her conversation with Sharon Gamble with a reading from the novel describing the moment her protagonist Emily realizes that her career is all wrong.
Security, peace of mind, was that so much to ask? Emily felt the weight of her wants as she and Nate and Trevor settled into their suite. They couldn't afford this room. They couldn't even afford the tax on it. Sure, she'd once stayed in Lux hotels frequently for work. She traveled regularly to Chicago, L.A., Miami, Denver. She stayed in rooms stocked with complimentary champagne and pillow-top mattresses, all on the company's Amex. Those overnight trips had felt like fractures in time, as if she'd stepped through a portal into a world where she was herself, only glossier. The trips were one of the few things she truly missed about her career. Recently, she'd also begun to miss the simple act of being skilled at something. Though she'd never planned to be in experiential advertising, she fell into the job after declining grad school, it turned out she was good at the work, often great. For a time, she even convinced herself it was worthwhile, until it wasn't. It fell apart in a single moment. She'd been perched on the edge of her creative director's desk, leading the team through her concept for a client's new potato chip, a toasted canola oil version of their market leader. The director's office was large but cramped, filled with a menagerie of blow-up toys, rubber monsters, movie posters, presidential bobbleheads, an electronic keyboard, and the requisite magic eight ball. Despite the distractions, the team appeared entirely focused on Emily. Her concept involved positioning the new chip as a niche product, rolled out slowly, first in only the top five markets, mimicking the typical rollout of a gourmet offering, with interactive street booths manned by actual chefs who'd hand out samples and suggest, seriously, beer and soda pairings. Once they'd solidified those elite markets, they'd launch nationally with a sponsored chip dip competition, revealing the winners in a six-part commercial series, TV spots with an ongoing narrative. At the same time, they'd roll out commercials for the commercials' meta ads. The idea was cheeky, especially for a low-market national company, a company that sold snack foods available primarily at mini-marts. The idea mocked the current trend towards small-batch gourmet goods, even as it lured in that exact consumer demographic. Emily's concept was both novel and, could it be, brilliant. Brilliant not merely in her own eyes, she could sense that the rest of the five-person team felt it as well. While she spoke, they remained hushed but jittery, as if carbonated. Other snack food brands had done almost nothing in the experiential realm. Nobody had even thought small, and here was Emily thinking big. As her team's excitement grew, Emily, too, turned giddy. She'd leapt from a ledge with this idea, and she was flying. Nina Searle, the creative director, leaned in toward Emily, grinning. "We'll present it as is Friday," she said. "Tom Bascone's group can produce the street booths," said Aaron Nielsen, the man who made things happen. "Shit, Emily, we could fast-track it." "Maybe not Bascone this time," said Nina. The room hummed. They'd nail this account. They'd make inconceivable amounts of money for the conglomerate that owned the toasted chips. They'd make money for the umbrella corporation that held the strings of their own ad agency. They'd sign other emerging food accounts. They'd soar for a while, at least. And who in this industry cared about the long term anyway? "So no Bascom. Fine, I'll get Cal Tomlin," Aaron said. "I owe Tomlin a favor. He'll love us for this. Everyone wins." "Oh, Emily, the commercials for the commercials," Nina flipped through the account memo. "Awesome." "Oh, Emily," to use a figure of speech from Nate's playbook, Emily had hit one out of the park. "We'll present it as is." Even Maggie Yen, the group's assistant, was caught up in the thrill, nodding in quick bursts, bouncing on the balls of her feet. "Oh, Emily." Emily was on a high, her chest inflating with the helium of a job spectacularly done. It was inebriating, even more so than the beta blockers she'd taken to calm her pre-meeting nerves, even more so than the four cups of coffee she'd drunk in gulps that morning. She wanted to remember this moment. "Oh, Emily." She was buoyant, aloft. And then, wait, what's that? From her new vantage point, Emily understood something that she somehow hadn't fully grasped before. It was a potato chip. So much glorious thought, all to promote a potato chip.
I had to bite my tongue to not laugh out loud at some of this, because it's just such a beautiful picture of capitalism in some ways. And I love that this novel is on so many different levels, a story of exiling yourself, the characters exiling themselves from what used to be that glossy world that they wanted.
Right.
It's like they're kids that with their face pressed against the plate glass windows of, you know, the candy store. And all of a sudden, it's poof, it's gone. Their lives are anew.
And I think these are characters, to me at least, who never thought they'd be the ones pressed with their face against the door. I think they always assumed they would break in and they would be fully inhabiting that really glossy and very expensive life, and suddenly it proves to them too hard to attain. And so the book really launches with them trying to figure out, well, if we can't have that, then what now?
Yeah, who are we now? It's also a really page-turning, compelling story about discovery set on a Columbus Day weekend. No, mm-hmm. No coincidence, I suspect.
Exactly.
You were living in New York at the conception of this novel, I assume. How did these characters come to you? Where did this story come to you?
I was living in New York for almost the entire process of writing the book. We moved to Indiana as I was finishing sort of the final couple of drafts. I'm not a fast writer, so this was the book was completed over many, many years. And I started it when I was in my mid-30s. And at the time, even though the book is about characters who get priced out of New York and leave to go somewhere else, having never thought they'd leave New York, I was still guilty of what they were feeling at the start. I never thought I'd leave New York. I would just write about characters who left. And then I found myself, as I was finishing the book, very much in their shoes. It very much started, but it turned out to be a happy ending. So
it's like lucid dreaming, but you're putting it on paper.
Exactly. Well, in my next book, I'm going to be a lottery winner. And
okay,
we'll
excellent.
If that comes true. But I was living in New York and watching. I tend to I don't base my characters on anyone specific I know or specifically on myself, but on ideas or issues that I see my sort of contemporaries and friends dealing with that weigh on my mind. And as I was in my mid-30s, I was seeing a lot of friends of mine having to reckon with where their life had ended up. The sense of, I mean, it now seems to me so young, mid-30s, now that I'm slightly out of my 30s. But there's this sense when you're in your 20s of anything can happen. Your life can go in any direction. And this there's an excitement to that. And then I was watching friends of mine hit their mid-30s and think, well, now their life couldn't go in any direction. And they hadn't necessarily ended up in the roles they wanted. And the first character who came to me, or the first two, were the book's main characters are a couple, Nate and Emily. And Nate came to me first along with his father, who in the book is a very successful, well-known architect. And this is based on watching the men I knew who felt very overshadowed by their fathers. And this is obviously not all men. These are the men I was interested in at the time, friends of mine, who were very successful in their own rights by many measures, yet they hadn't accomplished what their fathers had accomplished, and they were trying to live up to that and feeling like failures when they shouldn't have been, or feeling as if they were left behind. And Nate, in the book's way of dealing with this, because his father is a very visible presence, has been to not try to live up to him, to absent himself from his father's life, which is easy because his father is not the nicest man, and to try and escape the shadow of his past. And it turns out that that's not quite as easy as he thought it would be. And then Emily was really based on, well, the men I knew were trying to live up to these set standards that history and their fathers had set for them. The women my age, I was seeing, we'd been told, well, you can do anything. There's no need to live up to anything. And that's its own sort of pressure.
Yeah.
And so Emily is a character who all of a sudden, as I just read, the job in advertising proved unfulfilling, so she thinks, well, we'll do something else, but what else? So sort of the sky's the limit, and she finds she can't do anything. So in the book, while Nate is very focused on his past, she's very much focused and panicked about the future.
I love the scenes in which she brainstorms, well, I could be an artisanal cheesemaker. I could do this. I could invent that. And yet nothing really seems to stick. She's kind of rudderless and rootless.
And those were a lot of fun to write. I kept hoping one of them might stick because they all sounded like a lot. I have my own dreams of being an artisanal cheesemaker, and I know I could never do it for the same reasons I think she could never do it.
It might be easier in Indianapolis than it was in New York City, though.
Well, this has occurred to me. It may be in my future. In my head, as she was dreaming all of these things up, I thought, well, what somebody really needs for any of these ideas is a garage, which you never have in New York, to have your little workshop. And suddenly I live somewhere where I have a garage.
I'm going to get you and your husband, the novelist Michael Daly, in the same room to talk, to have this conversation about you never expected to live in the middle of the country, especially in Indianapolis, and your insights are an interesting complement to one another's on that, as I'm sure you know, because you have had this conversation many times. In what the heck are we doing to ourselves, right?
Well, that's what also largely paralleled my book, where the couple in the book is moving from New York to Newport, Rhode Island, having not really chosen Newport, but it's where the job for Nate arose, and so they went. And we had, while living in New York, much like the characters, the great wealth of New York started looming over us, and we are two writers, and probably were crazy to live in Manhattan for so long. And so we sort of daydreamed a little bit about where would we go, but hadn't really thought about leaving. And then this job at Butler University came up, and having never considered living in Indianapolis or Indiana or even really the Midwest, the job was really intriguing, and we came. And one of the things that the characters in the book talk about, or Emily thinks at a moment, because she's a little bit down on suddenly ending up on Newport, is that there's something really enticing about the random chance of it, about going somewhere you haven't quite chosen. And that actually proved to be really exciting in the end, as we were packing up in New York, and I thought, I don't know what I'll find, and it's ended up well.
The book has as its catalyst, an emotional as well as financial catalyst, the fact that it's set in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It's not immediately post 9/11, but I have the sense through the character of Emily that I understand a little bit more what it was like to have lived in New York City in the few years after 9/11, because everything shifted. The earth shifted
right
underfoot.
It was a strange time, and I specifically chose not to write the book in the year or two directly after 9/11. I think I'm not really ready to capture that yet. It was a very, very strange time. And there was a sense right afterwards that the world and the city would never be the same, that this was, and I mean, it tremendously was life-altering. But by 2004, the city had really resumed its rhythms in both a good and a bad way. The economy was on an upswing, which was important for this. It's a book that's very much about economic precariousness, and it's easy at times of recession to say, oh, people struggle. But I really wanted to show the ways people struggle and unexpected people struggle, even during good times. And so that was important to me. So the city was taking off again, but also people were starting to, I mean, I hate to say this, it's the wrong word. I was going to say people were starting to forget 9/11. But it was fading into the background. And I think all of those years of thinking, well, the world is never going to be the same, in a nice way, I mean, the United States triumphed, and New York triumphed, and we got back, and Wall Street came back, and we went back to work. But then for people like Nate and Emily, who are desperate for a change, to find that their life is the same as it was before, it was also an interesting time for me to be looking at their lives. What do you do when you were hoping the world itself would offer you change, and it hasn't?
And part of the response to this new normal is that they kind of lose one another.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, you mentioned that the title being The Exiles, which works on a number of levels. They're very much exiles from New York, as only people, I think, in New York can imagine it who haven't lived elsewhere. There's this terror of going elsewhere, and they feel as if they've been sent financially somewhere else.
To the
but
gulag.
They also are exiled from each other during the book because they have secrets that they're keeping from each other. And largely to protect the other. I do feel that they're, even when they're apart and their relationship is suffering a bit during the book, they're very much in love, but they sort of lose each other and become, it's easy to think in water imagery for me because the book is set in Newport, Rhode Island, but they sort of become separate islands. And that was interesting for me also, two characters who are together, it's just them and their 10-month-old for most of the book on this journey, and physically they're together for most of it, but emotionally they're very separate.
Sharon Gamble with writer and Butler University professor Allison Lynn, who happens to be married to writer and Butler University professor Michael Daly. Allison's new novel is called The Exiles, and she'll be doing a reading and an Indianapolis book launch on September 12th at Big Hat Books. Learn more about Allison and The Exiles at AllisonLynnBooks.com. That's Allison, A-L-L-I-S-O-N, Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Books.com.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
It's hot, and you're going to need some art if you've lived in Indianapolis
it's
for
hot,
a
we
while.
Need some art.
You're getting my reference.
There
if you're new to town, write us at artofthematter@wfyi.org, and we'll explain it to you.
Well, that sounds like no matter how hot it is, it's time for that calendar we call.
What will we do? Jump in.
There you go. Well, hey, Indiana Black Expo is, of course, going on right now. But one thing that is pretty cool, and there's a lot of cool things going on with that, and definitely worth checking out. But we got a lovely little book by a six-year-old author, Lauren Marie Burks, and she is going to be autographing copies of her new book, My 100 Hands, as part of Black Expo. She's actually going to be at Black Expo from Friday through Sunday, doing some different things, but there'll be a author spotlight featuring her on Saturday the 20th at 3 p.m. where she'll be autographing her book. Her father illustrated it. It's a really adorable book.
It is.
And it comes from a story where she daydreamed about having 100 little friendly hands that would help her do things to help her family and her parents and her friends and all those different tasks and chores. And that's where the 100 hands come into play. So it's a very sweet book worth checking out. Part of all the great events going on this weekend at Black Expo.
Hey, speaking of children and speaking of things going on right now, the International Indie Film Fest Indie International Film Fest is going on now in full swing, and they have some cool workshops, including this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the IMA, Children's Introduction to Animation. If the kids in your life love cartoons, video games, and great animated features, you can bring them to this workshop, and with two folks from Ball State University, and they will show kids how to make animations, and they'll even get to take some home with them. So again, that's Children's Intro to Animation this Saturday, the 20th, 1 p.m. at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
Sharon, can you believe it's only 4 weeks until Fringe?
I
know.
Where's the summer going?
So Fringe is coming up, of course, and they're looking for volunteers and all that sort of stuff. But if you can't wait 4 weeks for Fringe, well, you might want to check out their local performer showcase on Friday, August 2nd at the Cook Theater at Indiana Landmark Center. And they're going to be having Visual Fringe going on that evening as well, including and also some local performers as part of sort of a preview of what's going on with this year's Fringe. Get more information at indiefringe.org.
Excellent. Hey, lots of things opening this week. But at IMOCA, the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art, it's the closing day of We Buy White Albums, a really interesting exhibition that looks like a record store, but it really isn't. So check that out at IMOCA through this Saturday.
I just want to give a shout out to the new Indiana Author Award winners. Two winners have been named for the 2013 Indiana Authors Awards. Authors Michael Martone and James H. Madison are going to be receiving respectively the national and regional awards from the Library Foundation. They've just announced that. The big Indiana Authors Awards dinner takes place October 26th, so not for a little while, but this is a pretty big honor for these authors. Congratulations to both of them.
Go Bulldog. Michael Martone graduated from Butler.
How cool is that?
Before there was a blue mascot inspiring him to write. Well, there was a drawing of the dog. Yeah, there just wasn't a three-dimensional dog hanging out on campus. Hey, pianist Allegra Sorley and her mom, Dr. Rebecca Sorley, who you might know from University of Indianapolis, are presenting a benefit concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Lilly Performance Hall at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center at the U of I. Allegra is a 2013 graduate in piano performance of Roosevelt University's Chicago College of Performing Arts. And they're doing this benefit concert to encourage people to be aware of the dangers of secondhand smoke. They had a friend who died of cancer created by secondhand smoke, and so they thought, let's do something positive to raise the profile of this issue. You can attend that concert at 3 o'clock this Sunday afternoon at the DeHaan Center at the U of I. duo pianists.
Last thing, real quick, Anything Goes up at the Civic Theater. They're doing it with their young adult theater program, so kids performing this next Thursday through Sunday, the Great Cole Porter Musical with, of course, I Get a Kick Out of You. That's all the time we've got, Sharon.
We'll be back with more next week on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Without question, Dance Kaleidoscope is Indianapolis's premier modern dance company, and choreographer David Hochoy, who's been with DK for more than 22 years now, is a big reason for that success. This July, he's being named an Indiana Living Legend by the Indiana Historical Society. Then DK will perform the concert Classic Hits, featuring three of David's best new works at the Tarkington at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel on August 2nd and 3rd. Travis DiNicola spoke with David about these events.
David, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thanks, Travis. It's always a great pleasure being here.
I am so glad you are here today, and lots of good stuff to talk about, of course, including Classic Hits, and also there's this little Living Legend thing. But before we get to that, I just want to let people know we're doing something very new on Art of the Matter today, and that's thanks to our friends at Printing Partners. You can actually win some tickets right now to Dance Kaleidoscope's August 2nd or 3rd performance of Classic Hits at the Tarkington. Just visit WFYI.org and click on the contest box on the main page to enter to win some tickets to the show that we're going to talk about right now, David.
Right now. Get to your computer, huh?
Yeah, so this three pieces, fairly recent, but still, I mean, you haven't done these in a couple years. All pieces that that you've choreographed.
Correct.
That you've brought back. How did you choose these three pieces for Classic
Hits? Well, I wanted to do a program that showcased, first of all, the athleticism and the grace and the beauty of the company. I also wanted to put together a program that had very different kind of feelings, worlds together, and I also wanted to do a program that was classic. Mm-hmm. So what's really wonderful about this program, I think, is that it has everything in it. It has a balletic kind of piece, which is Ancient Airs and Dances with beautiful music by Respighi. It has a very modern piece, which is Electric Counterpoint, which is the Steve Reich music, being played by Pat Metheny on the electric guitar. And then it has a very dramatic piece, the Romeo and Juliet Fantasy, which I think is one of the strongest pieces we ever do. The company gets to show off their dramatic capabilities and their dramatic capacity as performers. And also the Tchaikovsky music is just, it's stunning. It's a stunning piece of music. So in all, it ends up being a really rich program, and it's very diverse.
I mean, it sounds like a really interesting mix of music. I know. Just before we went on the air, you were talking about how excited you were about the music by Respighi for Ancient Airs and Dances.
Yes.
I mean, just a beautiful work.
It is, and actually, for people who know the Respighi work, it is a collection of dances that were originally composed, excuse me, in the medieval times. And what Respighi did was he orchestrated them beautifully for an orchestra. Now, I only do four of the dances, but, you know, there are suites one and suites two and three and four, and there are lots and lots and lots of dances. But we do four of them, and they're beautiful. They're very light in tone. And as I said, the whole feel of it is very airy and very balletic.
Very cool. And this is all going to be taking place at the Tarkington.
At the Tarkington, which is a great... That's another reason why I wanted to showcase the company there, because the Tarkington is a great space for dance.
Now, has Dance Kaleidoscope been at the Tarkington before?
Yes, we were there in January. We performed our Frank Sinatra show, Old Blue Eyes, there. And we looked wonderful there. And I really wanted to take us back there to do something that was sort of epic in scope. And both the Romeo and Juliet and the Ancient Airs and Dances are very epic.
This is also a nice treat for everyone who happens to be around that weekend, because you don't always get to see modern dance in town during the summer.
That's right. As a matter of fact...
or any dance, for that matter. But, I mean.
Yeah. So, and it's wonderful to see it in this wonderful venue. And I think it's a great, great, great show. So you should go and either go to your computer and enter the competition.
That's right.
You can also call 843-3800 for tickets, too.
And I do want to mention Printing Partners, in addition to giving away some tickets through the FYI website, they're also the presenters of Classic Hits, which is
yes,
great.
Yes, and we have to thank Printing Partners a great deal, because they are they were over the title sponsor for this program.
Very cool. And if you haven't seen Dan's Kaleidoscope before, I mean, I would strongly recommend this one, because it's a great, in a sense, a sort of a sampler, an introduction, if you will, of the beautiful work that you guys do.
And it's a very family-friendly show.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. You can bring children to it, and I think they will really love it. And, you know, the story of Romeo and Juliet is so beautiful. It's so romantic. And we have three Romeos and three Juliets, three sets of Romeo and Juliet.
That gets tricky.
Yeah, well, they, because there are different scenes in Romeo and Juliet, and the first scene is in the balcony, of course, very mm-hmm. famous. The second scene is the bedroom scene where he's taking his leave from her. And then the last scene, of course, is the scene in the morgue where... he kills himself, and then she
That's
kills
an interesting
himself.
Approach. So you've got three different male dancers playing Romeo, three different female dancers doing Juliet.
Yes, because they tell different parts of the story.
And of course, each dancer is going to bring their own style and interpretation to each segment of that story.
Yes, that's very, very true. As a matter of fact, the girl who is going to be playing the balcony Juliet is different this year. She's new to the part. But she's one of our seasoned dancers, Caitlin Negron, and she's a very, very beautiful dancer, and I'm looking forward very much to seeing what she's going to bring to the role.
Now, are the roles conveyed in part? I mean, certainly it'll be obvious through the choreography, but also through the beautiful costumes you guys do? I mean, sort of like similar costumes that follow Juliet? Or?
Yeah. Well, actually, what happens is, Travis, is that everybody's kind of dressed similarly, so because it's... The what Tchaikovsky did is he created a tone poem on Romeo and Juliet. He didn't really follow the story sequentially. So what I've done is I've taken like different aspects of the production of the story, and I tell them in order, and so you will follow it. Mm-hmm. But the Romeos and the Juliets come out of a crowd of people, and all of a sudden you see, oh my goodness, there is Romeo and there's Juliet right
sure.
away. It's a wonderful kind of startling apparition that happens in the piece.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great night. And again, that's Classic Hits August 2nd and 3rd at the Tarkington. Now, I want to talk with you, David, about something that's going on right now this month that is absolutely incredible and pretty exciting. What did you think when you were told, when you found out that you have been selected to be an Indiana Living Legend by the Indiana Historical Society?
Well, immediately, the first thing I felt was old. I don't know if you have to be old to be a legend, but then I read the list, and, you know, in the first year, they honored Josh Bell.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's not old at all. So, no, I have to say that I felt very, very humbled and very honored and delighted.
I mean, how
that,
cool
that,
is
I know, it's and, wonderful and, that they chose.
You know, and you're not a native Hoosier, neither am I, but you've been here for so many years, and so much of your professional career has, of course, taken place here.
Yes, you know, I've lived, actually, Travis, I've lived longer in Indianapolis than I have anywhere else in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Isn't that an interesting thing to discover? I realized that about a year ago myself. I'm like, oh, how'd that happen? Okay.
I know. So, and you know, and when I first came to Indianapolis, I certainly didn't think that I was going to stay this long, but mm-hmm. I have. So, yes, I am a Hoosier. This is where I hang my hat, and this is my home. And I'm very proud to be a Hoosier, and I'm very, very, very honored to be honored by the Indiana Historical Society. Very honored, truly.
Well, you're in some great company with their Living Legend program, but I'm going to have to tease you for just a second so you don't, you know, you stay a little humble here with being a Living Legend. You are not actually the first dancer choreographer. I mean, Twyla Tharp was honored about 10 years ago, I believe. So
she was.
Which is pretty cool, too.
You know, whenever, Travis, I have to tell you that whenever you say the word legend, I always, I don't know, you weren't even born in the 1970s and 80s, but there was an ad campaign for Black Gamma fur, and there were all these ads in the magazines saying what becomes a legend most.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a very, very famous picture of Martha Graham, Rudolf Nureyev, and Margot Fonteyn all in these Black Gamma minks, sort of taking a bow and smiling. What becomes a legend most? So that is the first thing that comes to my mind. Where's my mink?
Well, so you're going to get a mink to wear for the award ceremony?
That's, I think it's going to be a little hot.
You should show up. Oh, my God. Just a little warm, though. Yeah. Well, it's a very cool thing. And it really, yes, I'm so glad to see this and that they're honoring you for the work that you've done through Dance Kaleidoscope and the way that the company has grown in the 22 years?
22 years. I've been the artistic director now for 22 years. I'll be going into my 23rd year starting now.
Wow.
So it's pretty interesting that I've endured this long. And actually, I'm very grateful that the citizens of Indianapolis have kept supporting us for this long, because that's the only reason why we're still alive today as an arts organization, and that is that we've received tremendous amount of support from individuals and corporations and foundations.
Certainly.
But really, the reason why we're here is because individuals wanted us in the first place, and that's why we're still here.
And it is not an easy thing to
keep
any modern dance company
going,
no matter what city you work in or live in. But the fact that you every year continue to present a complete season and have a company of dancers who can actually make a living while they're here, and then, in fact, over the years, I mean, it's in the hundreds of the number of professional dancers who've passed through Dance Kaleidoscope stores.
That's right. I mean, last season, we celebrated our 40th anniversary, Dance Kaleidoscope did. So we just came through our 41st season, and now we're starting our 42nd season, which is, we should be very, very proud that we have a modern dance company in Indianapolis, because there aren't that many cities in the country that have a modern dance company that's resident and that's part of the community. And that, you know, I think what's really wonderful about Dance Kaleidoscope is that we kind of, it's really, I think, we cull the beautiful young people to make them into dancers, and we present these beautiful apparitions of dance on stage. And I think that we need that. That we do need to look at these beautiful beings dancing beautifully to beautiful music all the time. And it satisfies a certain need that we have as a society to look at that.
Well, the work is beautiful, and the dancers are beautiful. I do want to also mention, though, the Dance Kaleidoscope does an enormous amount of work in the community in terms of education programs,
absolutely.
And that's a big part of your work, too.
We started in education, and we do a lot of school
that's
shows.
That's really your history for Dance Kaleidoscope and where Dance Kaleidoscope begun, and
that's
continues
where
that way.
That's where we started, and actually last year we did 15 school shows with the ISO.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to reach, I think, something like 17,000 children.
That's so cool.
Which is fantastic. Yeah. So it's really it's a great mission that we have. It's part of our mission to educate, and we really make a point of reaching out to the community in an educational manner.
So let me ask you this, David, before we wrap this up. You mentioned earlier that, you know, when you first came to Indianapolis and you weren't necessarily thinking you'd stay, you know, as long as you've been able to stay. And now, you know, it is your home. You're a Hoosier. You're a living legend. So in the question, what becomes a legend most, why is it that you have chosen to continue to stay in Indianapolis and work here? And what is it about this community that works for you?
You know, I think about that a lot. I think that I think I'm comfortable here. I think I was I grew up in a small town in Port of Spain in Trinidad, West Indies, and I think I'm comfortable living in a kind of a smallish town. Please don't take offense that I call Indianapolis a smallish town, but it has a small town kind of feel to it. Because I lived in a metropolis, but I lived in New York for 16 years, so I think that's one of the things is that I feel comfortable here. And my work is here. I think that I love my work. I'm very challenged by my work. I love working with my dancers. I love developing them and bringing them to the peak of their potential. I love seeing what they have to offer. And I love the audience reaction when they see these dancers develop in front of them. I cannot tell you how delightful it is for me to listen to people say, you know, we've seen this person grow over the years, and wow, sure, they're so incredible right now. And it's my heart swells with pride, because when I realize that I'm helping someone achieve their true potential, and that's a great gift. And I'm very excited by that. I think it's every day when I get up, I have a purpose in life, and it's wonderful to be able to go to the studio every day and to be able to have something to contribute and to bring these wonderful things out of younger people, like I say.
Well, David, thank you so much for the work that you do.
Oh, thank you, Travis. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And again, if you would like to try to win some tickets to go see Dance Kaleidoscope's Classic Hits, August 2nd and 3rd at the Palladium, at the Tarkington up there at the Center for the Performing Arts, then you can go on to the WFYI website, WFYI.org, right now, and click on the contest box to win some of those tickets, courtesy of our friends at Printing Partners. David Ho Choi, it's a true pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Travis DiNicola with Dance Kaleidoscope's David Ho Choi. DK will perform the concert Classic Hits, sponsored by Printing Partners, and featuring three of David's best new works at the Tarkington at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel on August 2nd and 3rd. More information is at dancekal.org. That's dancekal.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra, from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of Heart's summer production of The Taming of the Shrew at the White River State Park.
I'll find out about the Go Ahead and Play piano project.
And I'll see what Intimate Opera has planned for this year's Fringe Festival. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar of events we fall.
What do we do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.